Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and with me, as always, is temporary co-host Michael Kester. And we have two films today, and we're going to play a little game with one of these films.
Yeah.
What are the two films that we're doing?
The two films we're doing today are Touch of Evil and The Terminal.
We're going to spoil these films. We have, as you probably know, chapters in your iTunes AAC QuickTime feed iPod thing.
Similarly to a novel, which is basically what a podcast is. Just
No. It's not. You're getting there. You're close. It's like a novel. Do you know what an audiobook is?
Is that like a novel with chapters?
Sort of. Yeah, man. You got it.
Okay.
By year two, I will teach you what a podcast is.
Huzzah.
So Touch of Evil is a film noir, and I realize that most people probably haven't seen this.
Mm-hmm.
And also film noir, like, it's stylistically cool, but we can't just... Every time we do film noir on the podcast, I can't just sit here and be like, isn't the lighting cool? It's so black and white. Because that would just be the same show over and over and is also not 20 minutes of content.
And also, to my understanding, is the plots don't vary all too much.
No, okay. They really don't. They have really unique plots, but they're very like one-line takes on each other's plots. So before we actually talk about Touch of Evil, I want to explain this awesome game that will hopefully convince people to listen to the film noir segments.
So this game that you came up with and I completely obliged to... is to recast the film using entirely Robert Rodriguez cast regulars.
Right, which is what we're going to do with this one.
Yeah.
Well, we've decided that we should continue this game with different troops of casts.
Like with Rob Zombie or Christopher Nolan.
I don't know how long we're going to be able to do that.
Four movies. Four more movies, yeah.
All right, cool. So I'm really liking that. We're doing the 1998 cut of Touch of Evil.
Mm-hmm.
This is another great example of films that that come out and then get recut and then get cut again. You don't actually see the director's cut until like the director dies, which is, we talked about that recently on the show, I think with, what was it? Blade Runner, right?
Yeah.
Where you have this film that, you know, keeps going through these changes by the studio until the final director, real director cut comes out at the end. Which is funny with Orson Welles because he's not around to make that cut.
Mm-hmm.
So the cut we watched is based on the original cut of the film is from 1958. There's a 58-page document, and then there was an additional bad cut of the film in 1976.
There we go.
There's the numbers for you. So this guy, I want to give him credit. It's Walter Murch who put together the 1998 cut of the film. Based on Orson Welles' original memo to Universal about how he thought the film should be, which I think is pretty awesome. Let's go over our players in this. So we have Charlton Heston in this.
Yeah, we do.
Now, this is what I haven't seen a lot of Heston stuff, but
I've seen a lot of Heston stuff. My mom was a big Charlton Heston fan.
So I'm going to throw this at you and tell me what you think about this. I think this is about his prime. Because we get to the point where we have like Omega Man, which is clearly when he's just like a parody of him. Like he's running around talking to himself. It's just nutty. And I think even Planet of the Apes has a bit of like he's playing up the camp.
Yeah.
But I feel this is like definitely an era of his career where like you can take him dead seriously.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Later on, he started like filling the like most obscure, strange roles. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have Planet of the Apes. You have Moses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure.
El Cid.
Really?
Yeah. Who's Spanish, not Mexican, so it fit better.
Well, and that's kind of the joke in this, too.
Yeah.
And that's Ed Wood. They made the joke in Tim Burton's film Ed Wood, as well as Get Shorty. A lot of places have kind of made the, you know, Universal wants to cast Charlton Heston as a Mexican joke. We have him playing across from Orson Welles, which, like... These are two big players. That's one of the things that carries this film really well for me is just to see these completely different roles by pretty big actors of the time.
There's a bunch of other big actors too.
Yeah, for sure.
You have Marlene Dietrich in there and Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Janet Leigh in this too, who is Susan Vargas, Charlton Heston's character's wife. She has a really interesting role in this because We're not going to hit on a lot of the film noir essentials in this because this movie kind of defies a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
This was at the end of kind of the golden age of film noir. It was 58. I would say film noir kind of went from the late 30s to maybe the mid to late 50s before it had kind of this like revitalization in the 70s. And, it goes through these different neo-noir things. Yeah. Blade Runner is a good example because Blade Runner kind of brought back a lot of stuff from noir films. You had that Coen Brothers kind of noir phase in earlier in this decade. And then obviously Sin City borrowed a lot from that and stuff too. So you get like constantly every 5 or 10 years, this sort of big, it comes back in a big way. This was the end of the very first one. And it's not really a characteristic piece of the genre because it kind of moves away from a lot of the things, that the genre holds dear. A lot of things that, when we talk about horror, we've kind of taken horror to task for different pieces that, we talked about it a lot with the slasher stuff that they're almost pieces of camp. They don't need to be there. Stuff that you kind of just go, oh, hey, yeah, horror. So this is necessary.
Right.
And one of the things is this role that Janet has. Usually in a film noir, you have the femme fatale, right? Mm-hmm. That's like one of the most characteristic pieces of the genre. Sort of the double-crossing woman, or she's in it for some kind of monetary gain, or she falls in love with the lead detective or something. Here you have Janet as a newlywed who spends most of the movie separated from the other characters entirely. The one thing you do have that film noir moved more and more towards over the years is she is snappy. She's feisty.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She's got a lot of the one-liners. She doesn't get pushed around a lot. And it's weird to see kind of the different phases noir goes through because that started out with the whole femme fatale thing in a very anti like feministic kind of way. It was it gave women kind of something different, this kind of different role to play where they were, it's a different kind of role, but it's still kind of a demeaning role. You go from women as trophies in film to women as like sinister double crossers, which I mean is good that, on a very real level that the actors get to play something new,
right.
But it's still kind of a negative role.
Mm-hmm.
And as film noir progressed, the characters got more deep. And I think when you look through the history of film, that was kind of the era where women broke out as better actors in film, as more having more important roles. So I think her I wish I knew what else Janet was in, but I think her performance in this is really notable for that. Orson Welles is playing a huge fat detective in this.
Yeah, he is.
I don't even recognize him in this. Like the first time I saw this movie, I went, which one was Orson Welles? Cause you always think Citizen Kane, right? Model American, kind of like Christian Bale, American Psycho, like the chiseled American guy, or, from more noir stuff. He did like The Third Man. He's a pretty skinny guy. He's not this big, and he wore a little bit of padding in this film, but still he's almost unrecognizable.
Yeah,
He plays like this weird kind of Dick Cheney, the Penguin, Eric Cartman kind of character. Uh-huh. He's got that like load. It's almost like he's slurring his words like he's drunk.
Yeah.
And then later in the film, he is drunk and he has to play this guy who was kind of slurring words as a drunk. So I give him a lot of credit for that and for playing such a different character and directing at the same time.
Right.
So congratulations, Orson Welles.
Uh-huh.
This film opens with what to me is one of the more memorable shots.
Mm-hmm.
It's the long tracking shot.
Yeah, for sure.
We've seen a couple of those recently in films.
Well, Children of Men, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that had a couple of them, right? Some of the longer ones in recent history. This one is maybe 3.5 minutes or something. And it's done using something that kind of reoccurs in the film, this big crane rig, where you get a lot of weird overhead stuff. It kind of sweeps down. Logistically, it's really hard to shoot. And I think it's one of the more interesting shots in the film, which maybe you don't want to start your film with the most interesting shot you're going to have the whole way through.
Well, I don't know. I think that in this film, it works because that's what the film's about.
Yeah.
Is what goes on in that 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, the 3 minutes between the bomb being put in the car and the bomb going off.
Right. What we have to use our imaginations and assume is a time bomb, but it's actually just a timer connected to some batteries.
Yeah.
And you weave through this whole border town and you follow this car and the anticipation is kind of ridiculous. Like everybody we were watching it with is kind of like, oh my God, when's the bomb going to go off? Mm-hmm. What's happening? and then kind of explodes almost when you don't even really expect it.
Yeah,
it's almost an afterthought.
That was a little bit of a letdown for me, but only because of the genre I'm coming from.
This is
something that we're going to see next time when we do House of a Thousand Corpses.
Oh, yeah. It's got that shot.
The gunshot that I always talk about. In House of a Thousand Corpses, I piss my pants every time.
Right.
But in this movie, it blew up. And then they cut to the car for a quarter of a second and it was on fire. And then they cut back. And I'm like, oh.
Well, I think that's interesting, too, because you see it in direct opposition to when you look at something like Children of Men, mm-hmm. right? That is the long tracking shots in that are usually filled with a lot of action.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the two I remember off the... Okay, so there's the three. There's the car, I'm going to do this without spoiling Children of Men. Right. You have the car, actually, I can't because the second one is a spoiler.
Don't talk about the second
one. And the third is another long shot at the end. Yeah, you're right. I can't do that. But there...
Clive Owen's dead the whole time.
That's
now
not
you
true.
Now you can do it.
No, I can't. That's Bruce Willis, actually.
Oh, Bruce, I forgot. I get them mixed up in that movie.
Both of which may come up later in this podcast.
Not for me.
Really? Okay. Really. I'm really excited to get to that. So you have a lot of explosions within the content of the long shot. The shot, the length of the shot, a lot of the focus is on, look at all this stuff. Look at all the chaos ensuing around your protagonist. And this is all anticipation. And it cut the long shot ends with the explosion, with not in the frame, but completely in the opposite direction of where we're looking, which is an interesting way to do this. As an earlier kind of take on how you perform a long shot like this, I think that's probably something that people who chose to do such long shots after that looked at and went, hey, we should have put the explosions in the shot. I don't know if logistically they could have done that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think it was probably all because you're doing almost a stage performance at that point, right? When you're asking all your actors and all your extras, and there were a lot in here,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of the flashy, longer shots in films will do that. You'll move through a whole town or a whole scene. I always think of Boogie Nights kind of stuff where you're moving through the club and you're seeing all these different people have parts to play mm-hmm. over the several minutes you're doing it. And then to try and execute an explosion at the end, if it fails, you got to do the whole shot again.
Yeah.
And the reset is just ridiculous. You kind of get the feel of that beginning shot towards the end of the film too, which is the only time you really get a whole lot of that outside stuff.
Uh-huh.
The end of the film it's really characteristic in that it's one of the darker black and white pieces that you get throughout the film. Because a lot of it's inside, they're kind of interrogating people, or you have that that really kind of stylized shot of him in the Hall of Records,
mm-hmm.
you know, sifting through all the files of the old cases and stuff. And the end, you have him with this kind of weird, the other guy's wearing a wire, Pete Menzies. And so this is kind of a crude device. It's an old school wire where the person listening has to follow the guy with the wire.
Well, because there's an antenna.
Right.
And that leads you to believe that there is radio
I don't know if it
frequencies.
Ever really worked like that, but I always thought that was cool because it kind of sets up the whole final showdown of the film. You also get a lot of the smoky stuff in that last scene, which is another one of the characteristics of noir you almost don't get at all in this.
You don't have a lot of
people smoking.
It's just Zsa Gabor, but that's just because she can't actually go 10 minutes without smoking.
All right.
I doubt she was supposed to be smoking in the movie. They're like, okay, and go. And she lit up a cigarette and Orson Welles was like, okay.
All right, if I have to. So you avoid the smoke, you avoid the femme fatale. You have detectives in here, but you don't really have too much of a double cross. I mean, I guess you sort of do. You know, there's kind of this turnaround in the film where you get one of the major themes, which is something we paralleled when we talked about Insomnia. Another one of those films where you talk about, you know, the end justifies the means thing. And mm-hmm. I won't go on a rant about that because I did it, you know, in our past episode of that.
Right.
But you have these guys who are planting evidence because they're psychic detectives, right?
Yeah.
They're supernatural detectives and they know who committed, they feel it in their gut. And they turn out to be right even, but you know, they pay a price for the way they arrived at the place they did. Uh-huh. And I really like the film for that theme too, as well as for a lot of the kind of noir defying things they did.
Onward.
Are you prepared for this?
I've been prepared since you told me the game.
All right. We are going to recast Touch of Evil using the Rodriguez cast. Now here's the rules I think we're setting. The rules are kind of loose because we already drew up lists. We're going to recast as many characters as possible.
Yeah.
We're going to try. I think anyone who's ever been in a Rodriguez film is game.
As a notable right? character.
I would say you could use bit parts if they're really like, if they're really good.
Yeah.
For future reference, I would say maybe any character who's been in two of the director's films
two, yeah.
or one of their director's lead
roles,
three films or something,
okay,
you know?
Cool.
With Sin City is a good example yeah. here because Sin City has a huge cast
yeah.
and a lot of those actors don't appear in other Rodriguez right. films. Also, I'm going to throw out a wild card at the end here of okay. actors that need to be in Rodriguez films that we somehow didn't fit in here. And okay. I'm going to see if we can both forcefully insert them into this movie.
So are we doing this by character?
We have the gang. Right?
The gang, yeah.
Unfortunately, the gang, their names aren't thrown around a lot, yeah. so we're just going to have to kind of... head bobbing guy, I yeah. definitely have David Arquette
yeah,
for that.
Yeah, me too. I agree.
Maybe in a Bully. young like kind of road racers kind of yeah. role. For the lead, I would go Freddie Rodriguez.
Me too. I was really? Down Freddie Rodriguez for the head of the gang there.
One I'm really curious about is the night manager yeah. because he's kind of a weird one.
He's super weird.
I have a couple for him, but I have one I'm gonna ultimately choose. You want to go first on this
yeah,
one?
Yeah, I'm going to go first.
All right, who do
I
you
have
got?
Quentin Tarantino as the night manager.
Damn, that was mine too, yeah. yeah. Yeah, I was going to say special cameo by yeah. Quentin Tarantino. I would also have accepted Elijah Wood or Steve Buscemi in that role.
Yeah.
I could have gone
agreed.
With either one yep. of those.
Okay, Pete
Menzies, being, the yeah. Other detective the other, who yeah. worked with Hank.
I have Jeff Fahey.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I could see that one. Yeah, yeah, that's kind of a different angle too.
I had Jeff Fahey like going through a bunch of roles that I ultimately decided on him because I can't see Jeff Fahey ever being a bad guy.
So I'm going to go two different places that make me really uncomfortable. I'm going to go one, Powers Booth, I believe is his name, who was Senator Rourke in Sin City.
Okay.
Now, I haven't seen him really in anything.
Okay.
But I'm trying to pick out, you know, originally I always go looks, just who feels the most natural yeah. visually. Also, I want to say my final answer on this is going to be Josh Hartnett.
Okay.
I'm really, really like hesitant to do that because of the Black Dahlia,
yeah.
which was a... neo-noir kind of throwback film, which is the height of absurdity.
Yeah.
It's probably the worst recent film noir recreation. It's just absolutely, it's like The Happening bad.
But I can totally see him fitting in that role.
Yeah.
That works. I'm still sticking with Jeff Fahey for mine though.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, those are two different yeah. total directions, yeah. which I think will play a lot off of who takes Orson Welles' role.
Right.
So who do you pick for that?
I picked Mickey Rourke.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good one too. Mickey Rourke was, you know, he's a heavy hitter.
Yeah.
He was a bit of an obvious choice. I tried to go other directions.
Well, I was juggling, originally early in the game, I picked Bruce Willis.
Uh-huh.
Then I was juggling Mickey Rourke and George Clooney.
Yeah.
Because George Clooney's in From Dusk Till Dawn and Spy Kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I eventually decided that Mickey Rourke would win because he's got the, like, he's really gritty.
Yeah.
And he slurs anyway. And yeah. he's really like... He's just gritty and angry all the time.
You got to go for somebody who's a powerhouse, mm-hmm. Both as an actor and literally like the guy's fucking yeah. huge. I couldn't find a huge role for this guy. I originally wanted to go Bruce Willis.
Right.
Just because I have that remembrance of Sin City, not uh-huh. so much Bruce Willis in Planet Terror.
Yeah.
And Bruce Willis is a fairly big guy and I think he could do the detective thing well. You uh-huh. know, I've seen him do it and it works.
Right.
But we need more of a cynical detective.
Yeah.
We need the detective who can kind of, you know, plant the evidence, who thinks he's right. And I'm trying to think of somebody who just feels like they're down in the gutter all the time. Uh-huh. Like they've just been kicked and given up.
Yeah.
And so I want to go Clive Owen
yeah.
in that role, which is, again, totally different direction yeah. than you're going on that. But I can see Clive Owen in stuff like anything where he's like sort of the hesitant protagonist,
right.
you know? Something even like Shoot 'Em Up.
Yeah.
You know, almost doesn't even want to be there.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of classic.
And Children of Men
roles.
Too.
Yeah. You see that in Children of Men as
we
well.
We did the double feature with those two films a while ago. And it was really funny watching the parallels.
You know, while we mentioned double feature, we didn't hit on this before, but this was billed as the B movie on a double feature. I forget what the A movie was, but when this originally came out, you know, in the like the mixed cut between Wells and Universal that this film got, it was unfortunately not given any press, even, you know, in regard to the really A-list actors uh-huh. that were sort of featured in it at the same time.
Yeah.
I think this is one of the first movies where we can actually find a double feature in history that it was released under.
Yeah.
And I think it was odd that it was the B
right.
movie. So who do you have for our fortune teller tarot card reader here?
I was originally thinking
Now, you know my pick on this.
Yeah, I know
you're
going to
go Rose McGowan.
Yeah, you've got Rose McGowan. And that was originally I saw her and I'm like, yeah, that would fit. She's kind of got the like smoky look.
Right.
But I eventually went for Salma Hayek.
Yeah, I could see that too.
I went Salma Hayek just because she's kind of got the like seductress mystery thing going on.
I think Salma Hayek would probably play the role better. Yeah. I think that would be a really good, almost like The Faculty where she has a bit part.
And again, I mean, I was playing her opposite Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And Rose McGowan again, opposite Mickey Rourke, it doesn't make
it
any
doesn't
sense
happen,
to me.
No. Yeah. Although Rose McGowan is another one who was in The Black Dahlia who had an even weirder role than Josh Hart. Man, that movie is absurd. So then who do you put in our female lead? Janet Leigh's character, Susan Vargas.
I had Marley Shelton.
Why'd you go her on this one?
She's really good at being like a good girl, but also like, you know, when she gets shaken up, she doesn't just roll over.
That's what you want here because you want someone you believe is honest and really pure because, you know, you have to buy that she gets corrupted later. That's or not really corrupted, but that she falls victim to this frame job. I was going to put
Carla Gugino is my first choice too.
Of Spy Kids because you'll see later when we talk about our lead here.
Oh.
But I finally decided to go Brittany Murphy on it because I like the sass
in this
role.
I can see that too.
And Brittany Murphy doing her stuff in Sin City, I really see the like, you know, she's a really strong, powerful role. And, you know, had I recast the film myself, I'm always going to go that direction with my female roles.
So what do you have for Grandy then?
Okay, so Uncle Joe Grandy here, who is the hotel owner and the sort of the bumbling bee character who's
really
just around
with them. I
really
hope we have the same person, but I have a feeling we don't.
Well, so this game almost turned into casting by the Coen brothers because early on we see one of his sort of henchmen who is Steve Buscemi, right? He just looks just like him. He reminds me a lot of John Pulido, who's never been in anything Rodriguez, so he's disqualified from the game.
Unfortunately.
He's been in like everything Coen brothers with Steve Buscemi a lot of times. And is the spitting image. I mean, it's the same guy. It's like the guy that
even sounds like him.
Yeah. Well, even to the point of the wig in this, which was, I want to say the wig was, The Man Who Wasn't There. The, the noir callback, the Coen brothers did one of their sort of the noir callback trilogy. So eventually I had to go Cheech Marin on this one.
Really?
Yeah. I went Cheech Marin.
All right. I can see that.
Really? You didn't pick Cheech Marin?
I did not
for
pick
this.
Cheech Marin.
All right. So now I'm excited to know who goes for this role.
Trejo, man.
Oh, see. Okay. Trejo is going to be my wild card because I was thinking like, where the fuck does Trejo has to go? If it's Rodriguez, Trejo goes in.
Yeah.
And unless he's going to play your lead here. Because Trejo, see, I don't see Trejo for this role.
I was kind
the
of
role is too submissive. I was
looking. You've seen The Devil's Rejects?
Yeah.
Where Trejo plays Rondo?
Yeah.
The guy who's just like totally submissive to the police officer.
Yeah.
And he's kind of like, I don't know what's going on, but I'll do it because I don't want to get in any trouble.
Yeah. That's a rare role for him. I totally forgot about that.
I could see that fitting really well, especially again against Mickey Rourke. Who is the strongest person in the world.
Right. When you pair him up against Clive Owen, I just want them to fight.
Right, exactly.
Which is hard there. Trejo, see, I went Cheech on this because I'm reminded of Desperado.
Yeah.
And that kind of like, you know, backdoor crime deal sort of workings
I know
there
what you're talking about.
Totally
I gotcha.
Work. All right, so I guess we're going to have to pull a different wild card here for you. You have not used Cheech in any of these. Cheech is a pretty key player in Rodriguez stuff.
Yeah.
You managed to pick out Selma Hayek, which is impressive. I didn't think if you had to throw. So where would you place Cheech in this if it's not not as Uncle Joe?
I would put Cheech Marin. I would probably do if I were going to do the movie the way we're talking about, I would probably throw Cheech in as the guy, the character who gets framed with the two sticks of dynamite.
Oh, sure, sure.
Being totally like, what's going on? I don't know what's going on.
Yeah,
like,
right.
I didn't do anything.
Yeah, no, that's a really good role for him. Yeah, that totally works. I don't know where to put Trejo. I got nothing. If I had to take one of my, you know, I almost want him to do the lead, you know, because he's like, and you want to see Trejo in a lead finally ever. I guess if I got to put Trejo anywhere, I could maybe pull for him in Orson Welles' role, maybe.
And that's a hard one. I don't think you can't have Orson Welles' role be Mexican.
Yeah, that's true. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
Well, it would be an interesting reversal on the Charlton Heston thing.
Right.
Almost kind of satirical of that, right. Which I think if you're going to remake this film,
yeah,
like we don't ever want to be proponents of remaking any of these right. films because that's just a bad idea.
Unless it's Robert Rodriguez.
Right.
Yeah.
He should just stick with Barbarella and stay away from this. I'm stuck on Trejo. I think you win because I just can't place him anymore. I could put Trejo in the gang. That's where I think I could see Trejo. If you go more for biker gang, because this kind of went greaser gang, which is weird because that's sort of an odd era to place them.
But I don't know if the gang could, if you could have a gang led by Freddy Rodriguez with Trejo.
Well, I think I would swap them out. I think would take a lesser role, or I would give Trejo's role or give Freddy's role to Trejo and kind of do an older biker group who's kind of hanging around the hotel. I think that would totally work. That's where I'm going to put my Trejo.
All right.
Lead. I already revealed here, so I might go Antonio Banderas on this.
Yeah, that's the obvious decision.
Yeah, right. You got something else, or are you going to go Antonio?
Well, okay,
here?
So I finally decided Antonio Banderas.
Right. If you're going to go Mexican, he is the Mexican of Rodriguez film.
Yeah, plus on top of that, he would work really well in this role because he's got his job and his, you know, his new wife, which he's really having trouble juggling on top of like the whole problem and system being fucked up, which I can see Antonio Banderas handling really well.
Yeah, for sure.
I wish I could pick Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
But I can't pick Josh Brolin.
How do you see Josh Brolin going in this role?
It would be similar to him in No Country for Old Men.
Sure.
Probably a little bit more outspoken.
Yeah, a bit of a stronger role.
Yeah.
A bit less of a runaway role. Mm-hmm. Man, just another Coen Brothers parallel. Yeah. They just keep sneaking in here. They want to be in our noir pair up so bad. Okay, so I'm gonna put my final vote on Antonio. I'm gonna tell you about my process here going through this. I want to go Willem Dafoe at first.
Yeah, because it'd be
white
funny.
Man,
yeah,
fake Mexican mustache.
I thought about that,
And we've made constant allusions to that anytime anything is even remotely Mexican or remotely Willem Dafoe in this podcast. But you have that classic role of him on Once Upon a Time.
That's funny as
which
hell.
Is just ridiculous.
Do you think that's an homage?
It could be. It very well could be. In the commentary, Rodriguez talks about how he just wanted Willem for the role. And Willem did not have a mustache, knew no Spanish or Mexican, as Orson Welles would call it, and didn't know how to play piano. And Rodriguez was like, oh, this is movie-making time. Forget about that stuff. We'll handle it. So yeah, I think maybe it could be an homage to that stuff. He's probably a fan of the older noir stuff. I mean, at least a Frank Miller's kind of take on the genre. You know, ultimately, gotta throw the easy no-brainer choice in there. It's a no-brainer for a reason.
Yeah.
It is Antonio Banderas. Yeah. Next film noir, it's a ways ahead, right? It's like 5 weeks or something, is going to be Double Indemnity, which is classic. You'll see a lot of the typical film noir stuff you want in that. Relatively small cast. We could go Rob Zombie.
I think we should go Rob. If it's a small cast, I mean,
Rob Zombie is not a normal film troupe that film aficionados think of.
I
but
do.
It is for the show.
It's a film troupe that I think of because it's everybody I've ever loved in horror film.
I'm going to say that may or may not change before we do it, but the next one's definitely going to be Double Indemnity.
All right.
So see, this almost feels like the end of the show, but it's not. We got another film. See Double Indemnity and, write in your casting choices, maybe. I don't know. You can go to doublefeatureshow.com and tell us how you would have casted
really
this.
Does sound like the end of the film.
Rodriguez films. We got another film. Yeah. Stick around, people. Yeah. What are we doing next?
Watch more fucking The Terminal right now.
All right, The Terminal. Let's go.
The first concession we're going to need to make while doing it on this show is that it's a Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah.
And it follows the standard Steven Spielberg like formula for film, which is it's a little bit too long. The first half is entertaining because there is no plot introduced. It's just like, isn't this a crazy situation? And then the second half is way too plot heavy.
Man, you've nailed it.
That's what happens in every Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah, I think we can go through the entire list and they pretty much all, you know, he had some of that 80s, 90s kind of nostalgic feel-goodery.
Well, think about like, I mean, here, let's just, before we even get into the
experiment.
Movie.
Sure.
So let's take a more recent work. Catch Me If You Can.
All right.
Movie starts, he's a con artist and it's really fun and flighty. Then he starts like getting chased by the FBI and it's really heavy.
Yeah.
And just to go back to the 90s, let's take E.T.
Great.
Isn't it funny? There's an alien. He likes M&Ms and pretending he's a doll. And then the government steps in.
Oh yeah, you know, you're right. Even the older stuff kind of has that that same feeling. I think you could even say that to some extent with War of the Worlds.
Yeah, because it's just like, whoa, chaotic alien stuff.
You have the discovery of the aliens, and then it's like,
this is how we have to do it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's all like flighty and fun because you're just being like immersed in this totally new reality. And there's a whole bunch of like comedy and stuff that's kind of quirky and fun.
Right.
And then they go, okay, now that you're used to that, let's give it a plot.
You know, it's funny because as we were watching Touch of Evil, we were talking about dividing films into three acts.
Yeah.
Which is a fun little game you can play at home. Figure out, you know, just take a list of films and figure out where each act, you know, ends and begins.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you get movies that are longer like this, you get a pretty clear, you could still play the three acts game. You could say there's three acts in this film.
I would say that this film is two acts.
Yeah, it seems.
I mean, two long acts.
You could still technically write it out as three, but I think what you're seeing here is such a division between the different acts. The movie I always kind of reference in my head for that is Doomsday.
Mm-hmm.
Never has a movie been so clearly divided in almost three separate movies. And I think you can get away with that in certain styles, but I think if you're going to do a safe film, like I feel most of Spielberg's films are.
Well, because they don't want that contrast. Yeah, they have to be friendly to the majority of the public.
Right.
Because they have to, you know, bank at the box office, be decent around Christmas, and show up at the Academy Awards.
Yeah, I've always had a real weird feeling about his films because they tend to be a little bit artsy, which naturally I like.
Yeah.
If you listen to the show for any length of time, I really dig visual stuff, art house stuff. It's just it's a style I appreciate. It's like that kind of aesthetic I'm into. And you get a lot of that with his stuff, even from almost an indie perspective. You look at this film, you had a lot of colorization of different, especially when you're working in one airport, right? You get to play with colors a lot, not necessarily in lighting, you know, just in different tonal kind of almost just color filters for different scenes. And that's the kind of thing you really don't see very frequently in a, here's a huge blockbuster that's supposed to bank.
Right.
Everybody go to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In mainstream successful works, you don't see that very often.
Right.
But like you said, you do have that that second act too long drags down.
Well, and the second act is where the first act is kind of quirky and fun. And it's like, wow, that's so realistic. That's really how things are.
Yeah.
Second half is exactly the opposite.
Yeah, it borders on like absurdist humor.
Where it's like, there's no way that those two people would have gotten married after like not having a serious conversation about it. There's no way that, you know, people would have all banded together about the goat.
Right.
And it's like, I mean,
so the definitive moment here for me is the goat.
Oh, that's sure. It.
So I want to talk about the first half of the film before we get into what becomes the second half.
That's what I think we should do. But before we get into the film, I want to talk about Tom Hanks.
Yeah, sure.
So Tom Hanks is an actor. I've seen countless Tom Hanks movies.
Right.
I mean, you know, Forrest Gump. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of stuff before that was kind of quirkier in the 80s. So I'm not going to count it.
Right.
And then since Forrest Gump, he's kind of been, you know, heavy hitter, top of the A-list kind of guy.
Yeah, right.
He did Road to Perdition. He was in Catch Me If You Can.
Right.
He recently did...
The Da Vinci Code. Let's not forget that.
And after that, even after The Da Vinci Code, he's been in recent stuff with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, right, right.
Almost always Julia Roberts, because she's was top of A-list of female actors, but now I don't even know where she is.
Right.
Anyway, so
right
Tom
about
Hanks,
when Jodie Foster was, I think, during that era of film.
So Tom Hanks is, I've never seen him be a bad actor. I haven't seen The Da Vinci Code, but I've never seen him be a bad actor.
He's all right, Ned.
But I would say that this is possibly one of, if not his best performance.
Yeah, I would say that too. I was really surprised coming straight off it because, you know, you're supposed to buy that he's a foreigner. You're supposed to buy he's from another country and knows barely any English.
A made up country at that.
Well, yeah. And I never, like, I had never even considered him for that kind of role. That would be the kind of thing if I'm sitting around going, who do I cast for this? Like, Tom Hanks is like not even near my list. I wouldn't have even thought of it. And he absolutely does it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the things straight out of the gate with this film that I think is just absolutely fantastic. You know, I had and this suffers again from the Spielberg thing, but again, just let's treat it as two different films here.
Yeah, sure.
For the first half of this film, I mean, I had an absolute love for this.
Yeah, for sure. And the rest of the cast is really good too. I mean, you have Stanley Tucci as Dixon.
Sure.
And then I only know Diego Luna of the like three airport right. workers. But okay, so now we have the other actor in the film.
Yeah. Security guy.
Yeah.
You know.
He was okay. I mean, my issue with him is that he was a really like static character, and then at the end ended up handing out the big like climax.
Yeah.
Which like, I don't know if you can do that.
You know, I was wondering what they were doing with his character in the beginning, and he kind of became the star of the second act. Yeah. He became the big important player.
Yeah.
Although it's strange, I don't think they did that with screen time, because he was right. probably in just as much of the first half of the uh-huh. movie as the second. However, he kind of becomes the conflict.
Yeah.
You know, it's the catch me if you can thing. Uh-huh. It's like you have suddenly you're on the run in the yeah. second part of the film. I mean, this film, the second part is conflict.
Right.
You have all your really, your typical movie plot character development stuff mm-hmm. thrown in there. And I think he was part of that too.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they don't give him much more to do here than watch monitors yeah. and be angry.
Yeah.
We don't really get into his character much more. Not that we need to, but I mean, you know, you could have done something with him.
And then also Catherine Zeta-Jones, who's just awful.
Standard.
She's bad actor.
She's someone you look at and you know she's acting.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't work for me.
Well, plus like Catherine Zeta-Jones was handed all the Napoleon crap in the second yeah. half, which yeah. like just... Like, it didn't go over my head. It just went right through it.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't care.
It's so much you're being spoon-fed these yeah. metaphors, you know? It's not, there's really no metaphor to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this is a really classic example of our show, because we've never really mentioned this, but I think it's inherent in what we do. We look at film as art and as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's that sharp contrast between the two. We'll do headier films, or we'll do films that maybe even combine the two. Recently we did Spiral, which yeah, I think is a good right. example of that. A lot of time, Hostel is another great example, right? Hostel has a visual aesthetic that makes it very artistic.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot of really strong messages it's trying yeah. to convey, and it does it in a package of simple, brutal entertainment.
Yeah.
And some films are only entertainment,
yeah.
and we've covered those. Candy, as you like to call
DOA
it.
DOA is a perfect yeah, example of that. Yeah,
absolutely, where there's no metaphor. There's yeah. nothing to it. And some films are probably... too artsy to, I don't have a good example, but I'm sure half of mine probably qualify mm-hmm. as almost too artistic to even be entertaining
right.
To your mainstream audience.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a film that does both in halves. The first half of this film is more believable. You don't get into the things that, you know, border on absurdity
right.
or far surpass mm-hmm. absurdity. You're introduced to this guy and you get your major premise, which, you know, suspension of disbelief kicks in again.
Yeah.
You're going to have to... by that some guy has been living in the airport.
Uh-huh.
And this was something like, you know, I don't know why I didn't think about this going into this film, but when I got out of college, I just lived in airports for maybe 2 weeks,
uh-huh.
just flying around, trying to find a place to move, going and seeing shows and stuff. And when I saw that coming to screen, I was like, it was kind of reliving that, you
yeah.
know? It was hard for me not to just stop at every gimmick that they had uh-huh. and just go, wow, yeah, I did that. you know, every time he's eating something or where he has to sleep or the people he's meeting. And it's like when you're traveling that, you know, they touch on that a lot too. I think they're kind of appealing to, frequent flyers, business people mm-hmm. who spend so much time in airports. It's literally as if they live there.
Right.
I mean, I kind of binged. Yeah. I'd never really flown outside of that. It was uh-huh. kind of just like, don't get hotels, just go to airports yeah. and do that. And I really liked that about the film. I really liked that he barely knew English. I like how they ran with that. I bought the gimmick straight away and I went with it. I like how they set it up. You know, they set it up as, they give you the overall conflict and why he has to stay there. And, you know, you take it or leave it and you're going to have to buy it or you're not going to make it.
Right.
If you haven't made it 5 minutes into the film when they hand you this premise,
yeah.
which is a good place to put it.
Mm-hmm.
So people know, don't hand people a weird premise, you know, a half hour in.
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes in, he's already in the airport. He's stuck. Here's why he's stuck. There's war. Okay. He kind of gets it. And I bought it. I went along with it. I think the way they phrase it is the best when they first send him out there. They're like, you have the freedom to go anywhere. In the airport.
Yeah.
Which is great. And automatically made me feel, and this is something I think from an artistic standpoint to touch on, this is a 2004 film,
right?
So this is several years after 9/11, which is anytime anyone talks about or thinks of airports, it's something that it's just this strong, strong American image that's conjured up.
And I noticed you asked the question when he had left his suitcase on on the escalator, and it there's the shot of it like coming to the top. And then you're like, was this before or after 9/11?
Well, it's weird because not only has air travel changed, but when you make a piece specifically about, you know, being in an airport for your, we've talked about this before and how much I'm in a fan of the Dog Day Afternoon, you're in a bank for the whole film thing. Yeah. Or the, you know, phone booth is always the cheesy example I use. You're in a phone booth for a whole movie. That's where you're going to be. That's your location. And you have to write around it.
Yeah.
And phone booth may have failed at that. I'm not sure. I haven't seen it in a while. But you have to write something where the setting is not going to help you. You're in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this film does. And that interested me. The interesting thing I think about coming at it from the 9/11 angle is that the film really doesn't touch on it at all.
Right.
You know, they have security in the airport.
Yeah.
Security is the kind of thing that, you know, they're talking about a lot. But you don't get handed a lot of this September 11th imagery.
Right.
Which I think was a good choice.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
Certainly an interesting artistic choice, and I like that about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I was handed a project about being, you know, about airlines, that's the first place I'd want to go because that's a really interesting subject matter to me. But they wanted to do something else with this film. Ultimately, I feel like the thing they did with it was kind of wasted. You know, to tell me you have a project about being stuck in an airport and you're not going to handle any really even TSA Homeland Security stuff.
Right.
I mean, it's there because it's part of the airport, but so is Burger King.
Yeah.
And, you know, 9/11 and terrorism are no more a part of this film than Burger King is.
Right.
Maybe even less a part of this film.
That's probably about the same for the country, too.
I think that was an interesting thing to do with this movie, and that really piques my curiosity. I just kind of wish they'd run more with it. So they hand you, in the kind of split of this film, they sort of set up who are going to be the characters, although Tom Hanks is really the only character in the first half. You kind of meet the other characters, but you don't find out who they are.
Right.
And the second half, they kind of become the gang.
You know?
The people in the airport, as well as his love interest, which is only even hinted at in the beginning.
Yeah, right.
You have your female character come in and she kind of has sort of an interesting story. I mean, they do a little bit of something with it. About as interesting as you're going to get out of a Steven Spielberg love story.
Right. Exactly.
It's set in an airport, you know, where you barely know any of the characters. The point at which the entire dynamic of the film changes is the goat scene. And do you feel like that's the spot? Or
I would say that's when the dynamic of the film changes. It doesn't make me as angry as it made you. I mean, I agree. I think we both agree that the film, like, that's when the film starts going downhill.
Right.
But that individual scene seemed to really upset you.
Yeah, it did. Well, and okay, so here's the thing. First of all, we paused the movie there because I drank like an entire tank of liquid and really had to pee.
Right.
And I noticed that there was an hour of film left. And I was like, really? An hour? That's weird. The goat scene is the first time the tone of the film changes as far as message. I felt like it's because I knew that it was going downhill for me.
Yeah.
I knew I had an hour left and all of a sudden there was message. Now we were talking before, this is our very last show where we're not going to have themed double features, or at least some kind of connect, some reason for pairing up the two movies. But you found this interesting parallel between Touch of Evil, where you have kind of a cop and justifies the means. He's trying to he wants good at the end of the day and he's using bad to achieve it.
Right.
Here you have with the security officer a motif
the security chief.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. The head of security who, you know, the only interesting thing I think is given to his character and something I almost wish they would explore more. He wants something bad, but he's trying to stay within the confines of the law to achieve it.
Yeah.
He's trying to get this guy out of his airport, you know, which I don't think is really necessarily a black and white bad motive. Mm-hmm. You know, he has a problem. He's trying to get rid of it, but he does it in a very cynical way. He's like, not my problem. Make this guy somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
But he wants to stay within the laws of the airport. You know, he's a very by the books guy. And I found that to be a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
When they bring up this goat thing, see, this is where the movie starts handing you like moral of the story things that I don't agree with at all, which I could, you know, I overlook that in film all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something where the whole second half of the film, it had a love story that I didn't really buy into.
Yeah.
And it had these kind of points about things he would, here's the example. The guy's trying to sneak medicine through the airport for his dying father.
Well, I don't know about sneak, but he's trying to get medicine through the airport.
Okay, well, it's illegal. And okay.
But so, I don't know about, okay.
Well, there's the foreign barrier, the foreign dialogue barrier, which he doesn't understand. He's doing something wrong. So we have laws and regulations in this country, whether you agree with them or not.
Uh-huh.
Here's a small insight into this is we're not big fans of many laws in general.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that'll kind of color our commentary on this. But he's breaking the law. And Tom Hanks' character is using sort of the opposite, that end justifies the means things. He's trying to help him using a loophole with goats to sneak this medicine across. And what you're supposed to take away from that is that he's the local airport hero for doing this. But I don't buy that. I mean, this is the guideline here. This is really one of the only times they touch on this kind of airport security. There's a really, really simple, important reason that we have regulations on drugs passed through airports.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't go along with that idea that it's like to save his sick father, right. So we're going to lie about it. But it's a small thing, but I was willing to overlook it as they gave it to me a little spoon-fed. Again, just like the Napoleon stuff.
It was really heavy, though.
Yeah, it
and
was.
I mean, and the second half of the movie also falls prey to the Steven Spielberg-like score swells.
Yeah.
That
sure.
like
well, that's the thing, is it becomes a feel good comedy instead of like an obscure. It was kind of maybe not a dark comedy.
It was offbeat.
But it was an offbeat comedy, and it was certainly not a feel good comedy, right? And there's different things that make something a dark comedy. We've discussed that before. I'm not sure this falls into it.
I wouldn't say so.
Well, not even the first half, but it's kind of playing in that territory. The second half is feel good comedy.
Yeah.
It's all about look at this guy. He's beating out security.
It's almost even romantic comedy.
Yeah. And ragtag too. You know, it goes in this totally other direction, even though visually the film kind of looks at you feel like it's the same film. It's very, you know, a lot of times movies, it'll be like, how did that take such a weird turn? And this, the turn it takes is subtle, but it's very strong.
Yeah.
It's a very, the dynamic shifts in a very, very real way. Mm-hmm. It kind of hands that to you in a, it's slipped in there. You barely even realize it unless you're looking at it. And by the time you reach the end of the film, the big selling point for the climax here, you know, I mean, it's him staying. That's the big point. But he decides to go to America and, you know, cross that line in one of the weirdest, like, everybody in the airport is kind of, you know, what do you call that moment in film? Because it happens in all these feel good, you know, the town has come together to stop the one evil guy who's in charge of signing paper. It's like, I can't stand that stuff. But he does that over this ultimatum the head of security, the chief of security has given him that he's going to fire these employees.
Right.
Now, you're supposed to feel for these employees.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't. They've all clearly done pretty bad things.
Yeah.
And the stuff is, I don't know if this is just a semantic thing. Like maybe Spielberg just didn't think these things were as bad as I did. But you got a guy who's drinking, gambling, and smoking pot on the job. I believe in private enterprise. This is United. They want to fire the guy. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally okay with that. And then you have another guy who stabbed a police officer for, you know, whatever reason. Okay. Maybe he had a reason and he's fleeing from his country. Again, laws in place. If you're fleeing from your home country because of some kind of like immoral persecution, we have a system that they pointed out in this film.
Yeah.
You know, normally I'm not going to take a movie to task for weird political stuff like that, but you brought it up.
Yeah.
You know what? You brought that to the table. And so we're going to play, you know, by those rules. I don't remember what the third guy's.
He brought him into the food preparation area.
That
was a little contrived, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, but still,
they
can
do what they want.
Yeah. That one I'm willing to let go, but okay, whatever. So the guy's basically saying, look, I'm going to have to fire these guys unless you just leave and get out of my hair. And I was okay with that. That didn't bother me. I mean, it's not like he was sentencing them to death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the punishment was not far outweighing the crime.
Right.
I mean, when you stab someone and flee from your home country, that's a pretty big deal. If you get fired from the airport, I guess you'd get deported too. Whatever, that's okay. But I mean, you know, like you don't obey the rules of the job and you get fired. I just didn't buy it is what I'm getting at.
Right.
Which also leads to that weird mop versus airplane scene, which might have been one of the most heavy-handed, like not buying it things about the film. You know, running at the airplane with the mop and again, you get the Spielberg score swell. And it's like he's almost not living in the same environment we are as viewers of this film.
Right.
We're supposed to buy into this, and it's just not happening for me.
I think a lot of what this film rides on, and that's it's probably the biggest flaw of the film, is that because Tom Hanks' character, Victor, like, has fallen through a crack in the, like, political system,
mm-hmm.
the political system has to be the enemy.
Yeah.
I mean, this film didn't need to pick an enemy.
No, not at all. But it did,
and it picked the government. And so since it was the government, and the government is only existent within, like, guidelines and rules.
Sure.
The movie had to become about breaking rules. And the only ammunition that the government has in order to punish somebody, you know, like, for example, the blackmail that the security head was using was within the rules, because that's the only hand he's got.
Yeah, that's all, like, he knows is rules.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from.
The film has to ride on the fact that the government is based on rules, and that, you know, people are more than rules sometimes.
Yeah, right.
And if you don't buy into that, which personally I find a bigger suspension of disbelief than a fake country being overthrown while one of its citizens is in the air.
Yeah.
Then you're going to have trouble with the overall, like, message of the film, but specifically the second half.
Yeah. I think you could have still, you know, if you want to make this movie, if you want to make it appeal to audiences and still be about rules, I think you have to look at the rules that are in place that are nonsensical. And believe you me, there are tons of them.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about that on the show all the time too.
Yeah.
We have all these rules in place, and sometimes they don't make sense. And I think you can find enough of them to throw in your film.
Well,
the movie kind of picks on the rules that are in place for a reason. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to make this about rules.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm holding this movie up as, like, a important political documentary, and it's not. It's a feel-good film, but it enters all this territory that it does. It goes out of its way to grab
The thing is, if you're in the airport, there are more than enough simple rules to make fun of.
TSA alone, you could have made entire movie mocking.
That's what I mean.
And I applaud you for not taking the low-hanging fruit here.
Yeah.
But there's tons of other things you could have gone for. And I feel like the film just picked out a mixed bag of stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I really like the first half, though. We've got Waco coming up, which is the second film after House of a Thousand Corpses.
Right.
The Rob Zombie film, Rob Zombie's most recent film, Halloween, we're going to cover at the end of the Halloween Killapalooza, which we have coming up.
Yeah, so start watching Halloween films. The full Waco title, if you want to go find this. I don't remember what cut we're watching. It's the middle one.
Yeah.
It's like a 2 hours or something. It is Waco, The Rules of Engagement.
Right.
We don't really know what happened at Waco, so we're gonna solve that in a half hour on our show.
Yeah.
Probably not. It'll probably be like the Walmart show, and we'll spend like 3 hours talking
about
it. It'll
be awesome. And then in House of a Thousand Corpses, we'll find out what happened there too. And we'll solve that.
Good. Get to the bottom of that one. So start watching the Halloween movies. Write us an email about film noir recasting stuff.
Yeah.
That's at doublefeatureshow.com.
If you want to remake film noir, just get in touch with us. We'll cast it for you.
Yeah.
Using whatever random, like, maybe vegetables.
Whatever we'll choose vegetables for that day. Actors we can think of. And is there anything else?
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.